Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back to finish out our discussion of the invention in the early days of the motion picture. Now, last time, I think, should have been the episode where we talked with Scott Benjamin about the murder mystery, or the maybe murder mystery, the disappearance mystery.
Yes.
Of Louis LaPrince, the person who actually did invent a film camera and shot movies before anybody, before Lumiere Brothers, before Edison and his team. But in the episode before that, we talked about the earliest commercially viable motion picture technologies. So by the mid-1890s, you had the flourishing of Thomas Edison and W.K.L. Dixon's kinematograph and kinematoscope in America, which made roughly 15 to 16 second movies that you could watch by sticking your head in a viewfinder in a cabinet. I love the image. Like, you just got your face down in the cabinet and somebody walks up behind you and puts the kick me sign on or whatever happens in these parlors. I'm sure it was a rowdy scene. And then around the same time, you've also got the cinematograph of the Lumiere brothers in France, which projected films on a wall. And this is a kind of different thing because it allowed this communal viewing experience, which is last time we talked about how we think this is sort of important both culturally and economically, that you can show films for a big audience all at the same time.
Yeah, and I think that when we look at the history of film viewing and film technology, we see that that push and pull between the communal experience and the individual experience, whether it's the communal experience of the Lumiere brothers' invention, or movie houses, or places where we go back towards the individual experience, such as suddenly being able to watch films at home on television, or watch films on a VCR, other home media advancements, right down to our modern use of smartphones, where you can just crawl underneath a blanket and watch whatever you want with your headphones in, and it's, you know, you're all but just shoving the screen directly into your brain.
Uh-huh. And I do think – I would bet that film historians have some interesting thoughts about how the changes in technology, especially like home video, changed the art of film itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's had major – certainly I've read some about its effects, say, on the adult cinema industry. You know,
right.
Where they're, you know, obvious
– clearly there, yeah.
Clearly there, you know, obvious influences of the technology on that genre. But I was thinking just the other night about a different avenue of – of film enjoyment, that being riffing.
Oh, yes. So we're, of course, both big fans of Mystery Science Theater 3000. If you've never seen it, it's – well, you've probably seen images of it. It's the old TV show where they would – it was a sci-fi comedy premise where they would take old movies that were generally very bad and poorly made, and you'd have hosts who made jokes about the film as you watched. You'd see little silhouettes bobbing in front of the screen.
A human and two robots forced to watch bad movies, and in order to survive the experience, they riff on them. They make jokes. They talk back to the screen, you know, all the – this sort of, you know, humorous shenanigans created by the great Joel Hodgson.
Yeah, but this is, of course, turned into a wider genre than just the show Mystery Science Theater 3000. That's been off the air for, you know, 20 years or whatever.
Well, it's back on Netflix.
Well, that's true.
Yes.
But so it was off the air for a long time, but the tradition continued. I think it inspired a sort of style of media presentation. And it wasn't the only one. I mean, there's also – you were talking before we – went on mic today about this other phenomenon of not people talking during the movie, but the TV movie host. What do you call that?
Oh, like a daytime horror host.
Yeah.
So like Grandpa Munster hosting movies back in the 90s on like the Turner channels.
Or Elvira.
Elvira or Joe Bob Briggs, Monster Vision.
Uh-huh.
Where they're not chatting during the movie, but there are these bumper segments where they're saying, hey, how about that film you just watched? How about that scene with that monster? And maybe they crack a few jokes.
Right. So even if you're at home alone watching the movie, it's kind of like when you go out to the movies with your friends, and if it's a bad movie, you lean over next to each other and make jokes about what you're watching.
Yeah. So I wonder to what extent, like, these are reactions to these different technological advancements where movie viewing has leaned away from the communal towards the individual experience, but then we compensate for that through this pseudo-communal experience of riffing or the host speaking to you about the film. And then later on, when we get more into the DVD age, you, of course, have commentary tracks.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think the better commentary tracks, I'm thinking of particularly like the John Carpenter and Kurt Russell commentaries, director's commentary tracks, you know, where it's like you're hanging out in the room with them, listening to them. You're watching the film with them to a certain extent.
Listening to any Arnold Schwarzenegger commentary track where he just explains what's happening in the scene, and it's in Total Recall, the unbelievable distortion of the face.
But yeah, even that is, you know, sort of a communal experience. It's like you're watching the film with Arnold. So anyway, that's it. I haven't researched that to see if anybody else has given, you know, a lot more serious and structured thought to the nature of riffing and why it's important. But it came to mind thinking about the way the technology influences our experience.
Yeah, I have a hunch that you're exactly right, that there is this push and pull, and that we want to be able to have privacy-bound experiences, you know, within our own boundaries, within our own you know, the convenience of being able to do it at home whenever we want to watch a movie or something. But also there's part of us that cries out for that kind of instant reaction, you know, wanting to be able to lean over to the person next to you and talk about what you're seeing.
Right. Like, and a counter to that would, of course, be some of these examples that you've seen of movie theater innovations designed to limit the communal experience, where there are like dividers next to your head, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, I guess it's also going to be annoying if you're just trying to pay attention to the movie and the people right in front of you are having a conversation about whatever.
Yeah, well, it's the human experience as a whole, right? We want to be alone, but we want to be surrounded by people. And
we want the other one.
Yeah, exactly. The grass is always a little greener, right?
But we should come back to the early days of film and pick up on this technological journey. So we had the Edison and Dixon kinematograph and kinematoscope, and then you had the Lumiere brothers with their cinematograph. And these established some slightly different early traditions of films. And one of the things we talked about before is that there weren't already films waiting to be shown. So the people who invented these camera and projector technologies had to make their own films to go in them. They had to be not only inventors of the technology, but media producers. So Edison and Dixon's early films were usually like short recordings of things that would be kind of like circus acts or vaudeville performances. Here's the strongman. Here's a dancer or acrobats or something quick and interesting to look at that would be interesting without sound and last about 15 seconds, because that's how long the films could be based on the limitations of their technology. The Lumiere brothers created these short documentaries of real life with scenes like a train approaching the camera, or I was reading about one that's just five men diving off of a jetty and bathing in the sea. There's one that's got a bunch of photographers getting off of a riverboat for a photography conference in Lyon. It's riveting stuff. But people were really into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's the magic of seeing the moving picture without living in an age of just ubiquitous moving pictures like we have today.
Exactly. But the Lumiere brothers also created at least one fictional story that we mentioned in that previous episode, the classic The Sprinkler Sprinkled.
Yes, this was one of the first 10 films that they unleashed, and it is clearly a humorous little fiction piece where a gardener's hose is stepped on by a child, and then, of course, he does the natural thing, right? The nice comedic clown choice, and looks down the hose, and then that's when the water squirts him in the face.
I actually watched it today, and not only does he get squirted in the face, then he chases down the child and beats the child savagely. That's how it ends.
You know, it was a different type of humor back in those days.
If only we could have had the Sprinkler Sprinkled cinematic universe where they come back and that would be explored in a later film.
But you know, take the beating aside, it is exactly the type of humor that has continued to be an important part of motion pictures, like right up until today.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, slapstick humor is still a very cheap way to make a movie that can make a lot of money.
Yes.
But by the mid-1890s, films, we should say, were still mostly something like a curiosity and a technological spectacle, and less like a fundamental medium for stories in mass culture the way they are in our culture today. So what changed in between? You know, how do we get from that point to this point? One thing that I think is really important along that journey is that, of course, there were plenty of technological upgrades that came along to improve what people could do with motion picture filming and projection early on. But the one innovation that I think might be most important early on is something that is usually called the Latham loop. Now, we've talked before about how early films were less than a minute long, right? There were technical reasons for this. It wasn't an artistic choice. One of the technical reasons was the strains put on recording media. So these early films were shot on celluloid film strip, and celluloid film was good. It was more durable than the flimsy paper film of the past, but still it had its limits. And one was this. The more film you've got coiled up on a roll and, you know, you're pulling on it, the harder it is to pull to feed along past the shutter. Like, you can sort of imagine the physics of this, right? You know, trying to pull tape off of a huge roll and pull it really fast. And the way film cameras and projectors worked at the time was to grab the film along these perforated holes along the side. So if you've seen film before, you know, you see these sprocket holes along the side of it. That's so the latch or the lever can grab the film, advance it exactly one frame in front of the shutter, and then move it along another frame after that. And so if you tried to record or project a really long piece of motion picture, you would inevitably end up tearing it in the process, often by ripping through the sprocket holes as you tried to advance the film. And this actually put an artistic limit on the medium. I was reading a 1999 article for the American Society of Cinematographers by the filmographer and film historian David Samuelson. And Samuelson writes that in the 1890s, the problem with the tension on celluloid film meant that you couldn't pull more than maybe like 100 feet or so, about 30 meters of film through the camera or projector without tearing it. And this limited films to roughly 2 minutes runtime. Now, in our brains, that we're thinking like, how do you tell the story of RoboCop in 2 minutes? This is a RoboCop-less world. You can't have it. But it was actually a different question that led to the defeat of this technological hurdle. And that question was a more, I don't know, kind of maybe more mercenary economic one, but maybe that's just me saying that because I'm not a big sports fan. The question was, how do you shoot and play back an entire boxing match?
Oh.
Now, it's funny that, again, this reveals how little interest I have in sports, that I didn't even think about the idea of filming and exhibiting sports matches as like a major early use of film. But of course, this is going to be big money, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was mainly thinking about the you know, the artistic possibilities here, and maybe to a certain extent the journalistic possibilities. But then again, journalism would cover sports as well. There would be an interest in capturing what occurred.
Exactly. So there was a family company run by an American named Woodville Latham and his sons, and they wanted to pioneer this process to make money off of exhibiting boxing matches after they'd happened. So the idea was you film the fight, You screen it later and you charge admission. And obviously, most boxing matches would have been too long. They would tear the film because they're going to need more than 100 feet there. So the answer is something called a film loop or a Latham loop. And this invention essentially used wheels to spool out a kind of short, slackened loop of film ahead of the camera or projector shutter so that when the lever grabs the film to pull it down, rapidly advance it past the shutter frame by frame, it wouldn't be pulling tight on the entire roll of film. It'd just be pulling down from this sort of slackened loop of film right above it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So according to Samuelson, though Woodville Latham gets the name credit for this invention, the Latham loop, a sworn statement by our old friend W.K.L. Dixon, who, remember, invented Edison's kinetograph, indicated that the invention was actually the work of a guy named Eugene Lost, who was otherwise known for inventing the idoloscope, which was a wide film projector. And also as a side note, Samuelson notes that years later, in 1911, Lost would also travel to America to, quote, give the first demonstration there of a combined sound on film recording and reproduction system, though his method was not ever successfully commercialized. And actually, synchronized sound didn't become mainstream in films until the late 1920s. So there was a ways to go before that became big.
Lost, by the way, is spelled L-A-U-S-T-E.
Yeah, maybe that's Lost Day or maybe Lust Day. I don't know.
Either way, he was quite the inventor.
Yeah, totally. Double innovator here. The Latham loop was a big deal in addition to this later uncommercialized sound on film process. And the Latham loop was such a big deal that Samuelson writes about it, quote, "For filmmakers of the time, it was as big a breakthrough as anything that has happened since." And think about it again. This is so important because this is what makes it possible to have long films. Without it, we couldn't have long films.
Right. Now, obviously, prior to this technology, we had all these other storytelling mediums that were long form.
Mm-hmm.
We had books. We had plays, especially. But clearly, like, the medium was not ready to receive those longer form stories yet.
Yeah.
And this allowed them to receive those forms.
Exactly. And I think this is one reason early on you wouldn't have had people quite yet thinking, yes, this, you know, the film will become the medium for visual novels, that
right.
We'll adapt a novel for film.
It would be like saying, look at postage stamps. Think of the stories we can tell with postage stamps.
Yeah,
you'd be like, no, you can't. It's just not that big. You can't put Macbeth on a postage stamp. But then suddenly it's like, hey, we just figured out a way that makes the stamps so much bigger. And then suddenly the sky's the limit.
Yeah. And so there's another piece I read emphasizing the importance of the loop that was pretty interesting. It's an article I found in The Atlantic in 2017 by Henry Giardina, though originally it was from an essay series called Object Lessons. And its title is "The Camera Technology That Turned Films into Stories." It was talking about the Latham loop there. And it notes several things. Of course, I wanted to know, what's the deal with this boxing match that the Lathams were into? Well, mm-hmm. It's got the deets on that. In May of 1895, the Latham family successfully screened a boxing match in New York City, and the boxers were Charles Barnett and somebody named Young Griffo.
Ooh.
So I'm wondering, is this the inspiration of the character in A Song of Ice and Fire?
There's a Young Griffo?
You don't remember Young Griff? He's in the books, but not the show.
I don't remember Young Griff.
Oh, yeah. So. Well, he's a Young Griff. I don't know who won the fight, by the way. I'm pulling for Young Griffo, though. So this invention obviously wasn't just for boxing. The film loop or the Latham loop made longer motion pictures possible, and we all know the stuff that came along with that. Though Giardina's article is also interesting in documenting the obsessive tactics that Thomas Edison pursued in order to hinder the early production of independent films and extract every dime he could out of anybody trying to make a movie, mostly through, you know, obnoxious patent claims. Mm. Like, you try to patent every part of the process, and if somebody's doing it, he's going to be making money on it. And remember, early on, films were not thought of yet as primarily as art or in terms of copyright law. They were technology, primarily framed in terms of patent law.
So ultimately, all these films that are being produced, like, they're still nothing but proof for the technology at this point. Like the films have not really taken on a life of their own.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, audiences were enjoying them, but I don't think they thought of films yet the way we think of films as like, this is another medium. It's like, you know, it's like the written word. You know,
right.
We think of film as being something like that. And before we move on, I just have to mention also that in this Giardina piece, it talks about how it's been alleged that Edison didn't just use patent harassment on people who were trying to make films around the turn of the 20th century. It's also been alleged that he used sheer muscle and intimidation to control the early film industry. And the author here talks about an interview between Peter Bogdanovich, the 1970s filmmaker, and an early film director who was working in the early days named Alan Dwan, who said that, quote, Edison sent gangsters across the country to follow them when they went west, and that the gangsters would shoot at their cameras.
Oh.
Quote, most companies only had one. Sometimes they'd wait until a fellow was cleaning the camera and take a shot at it, anything to destroy it.
Oh.
So I don't know if that story's accurate, but wow. It does seem like another tally in the Edison as villain column.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The idea that there's so much. To any film that gets made, it's kind of a miracle, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much work that goes into it, and these days that was still the case as well.
Yeah.
But on top of that, you're going to have Edison's gangsters allegedly showing up and potentially messing with your camera. That's awful.
Yeah. So whether or not that story's true, of course, Edison couldn't stop. You know, independent films entirely. Films continued to develop in France and elsewhere. And then even in the United States, filmmakers moved west and spread out all over the place, and Edison's power waned. So he couldn't put a lid on all of it. So I think it's clear that the film loop or the Latham loop was a crucial invention enabling the transformation of motion picture from just a technological spectacle into a mainstream storytelling medium and an art form. Like, it allowed the creation of longer films, and it made possible new things that you could do with film editing. Now, we'll have to ask the question in a minute, who picked up on this opportunity? Like, who were the artists who realized, I can make art, I can tell stories with this new medium, who took advantage of the technology? But also, I was just wondering first about a question about film history as an example of something that can be generalized. How does a new media technology come to be perceived in culture as a legitimate art form? Because I remember, maybe you weren't aware of this, but I remember some debate in the mid to late 2000s where people would go back and forth about whether or not video games can ever be considered art.
Hmm.
And I don't, maybe people still have that debate today. I would say that to me, you know, most video games to me don't seem like things that I'd really think of as art, but I don't have any problem at all with the idea that they potentially can be, and some probably are.
And you're talking about the piece itself being in its entirety a work of art, not merely like encompassing nice production design.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, certainly video games today, a lot of them have some beautiful designs in them that you would think of as visual art. So the question is, once it incorporates gameplay mechanics and all that kind of stuff, like, does it lose some artistic quality then? I don't know. I mean, people have to work that out among themselves. But I also think about the same thing with virtual reality. Can you just take a virtual reality environment and say, this is art? I mean, it seems to me that virtual reality is sort of in a space kind of like the films of the first decade of films were in, where it's still maybe like a question of like, is this just sort of a new technology and a spectacle that makes use of it?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to how you're utilizing the new medium, because we mentioned plays earlier. I think a lot of us, I don't know about all of us, but I've certainly seen my share of filmed plays, especially when I was like taking Shakespeare courses in college.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them were very good because in many cases it is a film of a wonderful performance.
Mm-hmm.
But if the camera's not moving or it's barely moving, it's not the same as watching a film. It's not using all of the tricks available to the filmmaker. So it's very difficult, I think, to make an argument that a filmed play is a good film, even if it is a great play. Likewise, when you're looking at, let's say, virtual reality or a video game, it's like, is the video game just giving me some nice visuals and I'm having some fun playing it? Or is it doing something with gaming itself? They're doing something with the way that I interact with it that it is refreshing and unique, and likewise with the virtual reality.
Are the mechanics of the invention or the technology integral to what the art is or how the art works in the same way that they are with films?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, for example, film, the simplest thing you can think of, a film can use an edit to make a point. You know, a film can like jump cut between two things to cause you to have a connection between them in your mind. And that's a thing that's sort of unique to film as a medium, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I guess the question is, are there things similar in games, in virtual reality, where the mechanics of it, sort of the physical characteristics of the medium, are used to do things that other media don't do in service of an artistic design?
Yeah, well, you know, in gaming, I'm thinking the examples would be games that kind of lean into trying to create the feeling of watching a motion picture, but feels that way. You know what I'm saying? Like it feels like, oh, this is almost like watching a movie. I'm almost achieving something, but I'm not, you know, fully immersed in the experience. Maybe you're being, you know, hit on the head with a bunch of cutscenes, and then in between the cutscenes, there's more traditional video game like maneuvers. But then a game like, well, Soma comes to mind is a recent game that that we both played. It's a, you know, sci-fi horror game. And like that game felt like, as I recall, it was not heavy on cutscenes. You were controlling the elements for the most part, and the way that you interacted with elements helped tell the story of your experience.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's a very good candidate for that kind of thing.
Yeah, as opposed to, say, many, say, fighting games or shooting games where you're just doing the fighting or the shooting, and then there are moments that come along where, like, hey, I'm here to tell you what the narrative is and how the story is progressing, and then you move back to the thing you were doing.
Right. If I know anything, it's that twisted metal is art.
Well, you know, I mean, I was thinking about the most recent, say, Mortal Kombat game as an example.
Oh, you're a fan of those, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I would never say that
I didn't mean that in a derogatory way.
No, no, no. It's not a game that I would say is art, though it combined, it clearly was built on the talents of numerous, you know, very accomplished artists. There's a lot of cool art in the game. And then there is a certain amount of storytelling that takes place in the game, but the core game experience is still not a narrative. It is a fighting.
Yeah.
I mean, to a certain extent, a fight is a narrative, but you know what I mean.
Then again, if we're starting to set a high bar about what counts as art and what doesn't, most films probably don't count either. I mean, who knows? I'm sorry. I guess this is a pretentious discussion, and it's my fault because I started it. I mean, we're not the Council of Wizards that decides what is art and what is not.
Well, but I think here's one of the things that about it, though, is like, are you using tricks and various bells and whistles of the medium to engage the audience? And I think one of the important things to keep in mind about cinema, about filmmaking, is that a filmmaker benefits from a great number of tricks and effects to capture our attention and manipulate our feelings. And these weren't just all rolled out at once. So it's not like Edison or anybody else came along and said, all right, here's how you make a film. Here are all the techniques you can do. Here are the types of cuts, et cetera. Like these were all developed mostly through trial and error over decades and decades of filmmaking. And that means the work of, you know, highly acclaimed and serious filmmakers, as well as everybody else involved in the game of making films. This was pointed out, by the way, in Psychocinematics, Issue and Directions by author P. Shimomura. So, you know, little changes here and there, new advancements in cinema that allow a film to get its hooks into us. So ultimately, I don't think it, you know, matters if, say, The Blob is a work of art. But clearly it's using all of these various artistic tools that were created to better tell a story, to better engage a viewer through the medium of cinema.
Yeah, and I would also say that I think you can make the point that commercial cinema develops techniques that are crucial to later art.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think maybe we should take a break, and then when we come back, we will discuss some of these early innovators in the art form of film.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product. And yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year. Equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
All right, we're back.
Okay, so we've been asking this question throughout of how did film and motion picture transition from being just a technological curiosity, you know, a new invention and a spectacle into something that was more oriented around narrative and story and something that might be considered a legitimate art form. And so we want to talk about just a couple of important figures here. One that I think is definitely worth mentioning is an interesting figure named Alice Guy Blaché. In the words of the American filmmaker and film scholar Wheeler Winston Dixon from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, she was, quote, the foremost pioneer of cinema, which I think is interesting because before preparing for this episode, I want to be honest, I had not heard of her.
Yeah, and most of the names that come up are men from cinema history. So it's refreshing to see a woman playing such an important role early on.
And I think it is highly possible that her gender might have had something to do with the reason she wasn't remembered as much as she probably should have been. So Alice Guy Blachet was born Alice Guy in France in 1873. She grew up going to Catholic school, and she early on had a love of narrative literature and theater. She was a fan of the arts. And she began her career in 1894 as a secretary working for the engineer, inventor, and industrialist Léon Gaumont. In the mid-1890s, Gaumont ran a photography company, so he made equipment and materials for this brand new film industry. For example, this company had a relationship producing equipment for the Lumiere brothers. And through her work with Gaumont's company, she was able to attend the Lumiere brothers' projected film premiere in 1895. We talked about this in the previous episode.
Oh, yeah. So she got to see the sprinkler sprinkled at the premiere.
Okay. She was there.
And by the way, all of these old films we're talking about, these little short films, they are all available on YouTube.
Well, the Lumiere brothers ones, I think, are.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But some of these others that we are discussing, like we've looked up on YouTube. So, there's a YouTube for all of its crimes and sins is still a great place to find these little tidbits of cinematic history.
Yeah. Well, the ones that are available, you should definitely look up and check out. A lot of them are actually lost to history.
Yes. The ones that are lost, you're not going to find on YouTube. But the others are fair game.
We'll talk about that in a minute. So she's working for Gaumont's company. She attends the Lumiere premiere. And by 1896, it appears she'd gotten a bug, even though she was still officially only a secretary at Gaumont's company. Guy had become interested in filmmaking as an art form and wanted to see what she could do crafting films herself. Now, remember, this is an age dominated by films that are less than 1 minute long. They're mostly like documentaries about people getting off a boat, you know?
Yeah.
So that year, in 1896, Guy got Gaumont to let her use the company's equipment to direct her own feature, to direct a roughly one-minute film of her own called The Cabbage Fairy, or La Fée aux Choux, on her lunch break. She made the movie at lunch. And this film involves this beaming fairy woman in a gated garden pulling real babies out of giant heads of cabbage. It's pretty creepy. There is something, I think, captivating about it. I mean, it doesn't have much of a plot, but I couldn't take my eyes off it.
Yeah, I watched this as well. Again, this one's definitely on YouTube. And it's pretty captivating and kind of predicts the popularity of Cabbage Patch Kids later on.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. So this is sometimes cited as the first fictional film. I do think that's debatable because why doesn't The Sprinkler Sprinkled from 1895 count?
That doesn't contain a speculative element, right?
That's true.
Whereas, you know, babies coming out of cabbage, that's clearly speculative.
That is exactly what I was about to say. Whatever one comes down to on that question, whether it's the first fictional film, it did occur to me, is this the first ever fantasy film? It's possible I'm missing something, but I can't find an earlier example. And the films you see most often cited as the earliest fantasy films are films by a filmmaker we're about to talk about named Georges Méliès from like 1902. So this is much earlier than that. And unless somebody can provide a counterexample, I'm going to say that this is the first fantasy film ever made, The Cabbage Fairy.
Now, what was the date on Edison's Frankenstein adaptation?
Oh, 1910.
All right, so she still beat him
way after. Yeah, okay. That's way after Méliès. Though that is worth a look.
Oh, yes. Especially crazy looking Frankenstein monster there.
Especially given what you know about Edison. Yeah. Right? It's almost like a metaphor. but so anyway, Alice Guy, The Cabbage Fairy. Based on her success in directing The Cabbage Fairy, Guy went on to direct and produce more films, and she was eventually made the head of production when Gaumont's company transitioned from being a technical camera and equipment business into a full-fledged film studio. And it's interesting how you see this transition happening over and over again with Edison, with Lumiere, with Gaumont. You know, people get into the film business, and then they're like, I don't want to be just on the technical side. I want to be making movies. Hmm. So Guy directed hundreds of films, and she oversaw the production of hundreds more. Perhaps her most famous film and the best remembered one is one from 1906 called The Life of Christ. Of course, it is a silent retelling of the life of Jesus. It's a little over 30 minutes long, and I watched some scenes from it. For example, the scene where Mary Magdalene washes the feet of Christ, and I watched the crucifixion scene. And it's a beautiful film in many ways. Like, the sets and the costumes and the staging are wonderful for 1906. In 1907, she married a Gaumont camera operator named Herbert Blachet, and she became Alice Guy Blachet. And after that, the two of them traveled to the United States, where Alice founded a new film production company of her own in New York called the Solax Company. And so Guy Blachet was prolific. Over the course of her career, she wrote, directed, and produced more than 1,000 movies.
Wow.
Sometimes like 3 movies a week. The last movie she made was in 1920. She died in New Jersey in 1968. Unfortunately, most of her films, like many films of this era, have been lost. So we can't go back now and watch them. For a long time, it seems Guy Blachet was left out of many film histories, like we were talking about. So there'd be histories of the period that just didn't really mention her, though some did. I want to say that there have been some people on I've read saying that she was like completely forgotten until recent years. And that's not entirely true, but it does seem that her role in the history of film has been grossly underemphasized. And it does seem now that there's sort of a revival in attention to her story in the past few years, including I was looking, there was a documentary film about her that came out in 2018 called Be Natural, narrated by Jodie Foster.
Oh.
And I haven't seen the movie, but I like the title because I think the title comes from another thing I've read about her, which is that in her studio, she hung up a sign urging actors to be natural, which is kind of hilarious if you think about the other staged films from this time, such as those of the great George Méliès, with all these wild, exaggerated gestures and movements in them, you know?
Which really, I think, was a benefit to those films because,
yeah.
I mean, you're dealing with – you're so far removed from capturing a natural performance.
Yeah, there's no sound.
Right, there's no sound. So, yeah, like scream and contort your face mm-hmm. as much as possible because you really almost have to shout through the limitations of the medium.
Yeah. So to quote again from Wheeler Winston Dixon, the scholar who called her the foremost pioneer of cinema, Dixon also argues, quote, she's basically the first person to make a film with a plot, the first person to use color, and this wasn't color photography, this would mean hand-tinted films, and also the first person to use the chronophone process, which was an early sound-on-film method that, like the other one we mentioned earlier, it did not commercially take off for a while. Again, sound-on-film didn't become mainstream until the late 1920s.
Yeah, but she's looking ahead, though. She kind of sees the future. And ultimately, the whole idea of asking the actors to be natural, I mean, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Like nowadays, a lot of movies, certainly in your more serious dramatic pieces, like that's where the focus is. You want to capture all the emotional nuance of a performance. And she saw that when others did not.
Yeah, these early films were very – well, again, they were still – it was still the spirit of spectacle in a way.
Mm-hmm.
They were very stagey, you know, these huge motions not to capture any kind of nuance of the characters but more in the spirit of vaudeville, exaggerated motions to really draw the eye and engage people and not ask them to like very boldly telegraph everything to avoid subtlety.
Right, because the another thing to keep in mind is that the medium is ultimately going to change the way that you can bring an actor's performance alive. Like it's going to make those really close, tense, studied scenes of an actor's facial expressions possible in ways that a stage production never would.
Yeah, and these earlier films were generally more like stage productions. They usually didn't have things like close-ups.
Right.
Now, I think maybe we should take another break, and then when we come back, we will discuss another better-known but also genuinely amazing and influential early film pioneer.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billings, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
All right, we're back. So let's go to the moon.
Oh, I think we should. So one of the most important people in the transition from film as straightforward recording of documentary spectacle to longer narrative form is Georges Méliès, who lived 1861 to 1938. And even if you don't know much about early film history, you are probably still a little bit familiar with Méliès through his 1902 film Le Voyage dans la Lune, or A Trip to the Moon, in which some learned astronomers dressed like goobery wizards fly to the moon in a giant artillery shell. They land there. They meet some moon men. They smash them with umbrellas and make them explode. They capture a moon being, and then they travel back home.
Yeah, that's the plot.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think everyone out there, either you have seen this in its entirety, then you have seen allusions to it, right? Or you've seen, didn't the Smashing Pumpkins, I think, had a music video.
Yeah.
That they utilize a lot of the visuals from this picture.
Well, the most famous image from it is something you've probably seen. It's the one where the ship lands on the moon and there's a close-up of the moon, which has a human face.
Right.
And there are special effects that do a cut to make the ship smash into the face, and then the face looks very displeased.
Right.
And so A Trip to the Moon is just still excellent to watch today.
Yeah, it's just really kind of wackadoodle to watch because it's not quite – it's certainly not a film play, but there is this sense of – it's kind of like a film spectacle. Like yeah. There are these scenes on that you're presented with where you're just – there's something phantasmagoric about it.
Oh, yeah. And only 13 minutes long.
Yeah.
Very short time
you're
investment.
You're in and out. It's like it's really the perfect film for today's attention span.
And it wasn't Méliès' only film, of course. He made all kinds of stuff. He was another great pioneer in early film production. And I like that you say that it does incorporate more of that tradition of spectacle because there are some things about him that I think will explain that. Now, like Guy Blachet, he was one of the first to see the storytelling potential of film as a medium. In the mid-1890s, Méliès was a stage magician and a theater director in Paris. And also, like Guy Blachet, he was present for the earliest demonstrations of the Lumière brothers. So when they're showing this thing on the wall, the Lumière brothers are like, check out our cinematograph. And multiple members of the audience are like, I can do this. I can make a career out of this.
Or he's probably thinking, I could do better. Man, you're just filming people leaving a factory. Uh-huh. I could build you a set.
Yeah.
I could perform you for you an illusion.
I can make you a cabbage fairy. Yeah. You know, I can take you to the moon.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so when Méliès saw what the Lumière's camera and projector could do, he pretty much immediately imagined the potential of the medium. He acquired a camera of his own. He founded a film studio, which I've seen described as like a giant glass house to let in as much light as possible for filming, and he started making movies. And Méliès, in a way, brought the spirit of a stage magician to the technology of the movie camera. He employed trickery, and that is one thing that he really revolutionized about early film. He pioneered many kinds of editing techniques and in-camera special effects that are inspired by the tricks that stage magicians would use.
Yeah, trickery is so essential to the filmmaking process. We lose sight of it. Mm-hmm. Like I lose sight of that aspect until I find myself explaining films to my son, who asks, like, how did they do that? How did this, you know, have the Skeksis disappear in this scene? Uh-huh. Or, you know, how did this happen? How did that the special effect occur? And then I have to stop and break it down a little bit and like, well, it's a trick. They stop filming and then they move things around and then they start filming, explanations of that manner. But yeah, they are all essentially based in tricking the audience into thinking something happened that didn't happen.
Well, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the source on this because this is a story I remember from years ago, but I think there is a story that Méliès told that, you know, that he discovered the possibilities for special effects when one day, like, he was filming something and then he just stopped while he was and then he started filming again. And then when he watched it played back, there was a jump cut. And he, you know, that was like, oh, I can just transition from one thing immediately to another if I stop working the camera and then start it up with something different in place. And it's like magic. It's like something disappears and appears somewhere else.
Right.
That's so obvious to us now who, you know, we're familiar with movie special effects. It's hard for us to appreciate how revolutionary of an insight that was.
Right. And it would make sense that a magician would see it, like whose trade depends on misdirection and, and also playing with expectations.
Yeah. And so Méliès was the first great special effects wizard. He used all kinds of tricks. He pioneered double exposures, you know, where you would run the film through the camera twice. And the second time it would also pick up a trace of an image. One would be would come through stronger on the film than the other. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you could do all kinds of interesting special effects like that. He used jump cut editing like we were just talking about. And his movies are generally still pretty wonderful to behold. There was a 1901 film he did called The Man with the Rubber Head that I watched earlier today. And in this film, Méliès uses special effects to make duplicates of his own severed head, which he then inflates with a furnace pump until it explodes.
And I believe from reading about his films, he also put an emphasis on music.
Yes.
Having some form of live music present to fully bring the production alive.
But this was still the silent film era, so there was no sound on film. The film would not have a dedicated soundtrack that went along with it unless, like, you know, you had like a score written out and had to say, okay, give this to the piano player in the theater or something.
Right. Or in some cases, I believe there would be like recommendations. Like, here's a song you can play for this particular short film.
Uh-huh. And so the case of a Trip to the Moon makes me think about an interesting modern phenomenon with early film, which is this thing I've encountered several times of rescoring old silent films or films that were made with older soundtracks by modern musicians. And I really am interested in this phenomenon and I like it. I want more bands to create, you know, a track synchronized to A Voyage to the Moon.
Yeah, not enough of them do it. Of course, Air did a soundtrack to Voyage to the Moon, 2012's Le Voyage dans la Lune,
mm-hmm.
Which I remember when it came out, and because I love Air. Air, a terrific act. And I remember liking it at the time. I haven't listened to it a lot.
Oh, okay. I haven't heard it.
It's good. That being said, I have not listened to the album synced with the movie itself.
I see. I know people have done this with. In fact, I've watched more than one modern rescoring of Metropolis, the Fritz Lang
yes.
movie, which is, of course, you know, it doesn't have its own sound, and it's this, but it's different because it's like a long science fiction feature.
Yeah, it is a full feature. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Moroder, the French electronic artist.
Giorgio Moroder. Yeah,
yeah. Which. I remember like getting into it. I was like, all right, I'm going to watch Metropolis. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use this score. And I really wanted to like it more than I did.
Oh.
So I ended up just playing a bunch of Kraftwerk over it instead of anything that had been, you know, that was a dedicated composition for Metropolis. And I have to say Kraftwerk worked really well.
I think Autobahn did a good one too.
Yeah. but various folks have covered Metropolis over the years. I found one that was really interesting by a group called the New Pollutants, and they did a pretty cool rescore of it that's, as of this recording, fully available on YouTube. It's from like 2010.
I think I may have actually watched it with this soundtrack before. I've watched it with multiple soundtracks.
Another one that comes to mind, that you brought this one up, Dracula.
Oh,
which was not a silent film.
No.
But it has been rescored.
Yeah.
This one was by Philip Glass, and the most famous performance was by the Kronos Quartet.
Uh-huh.
And then some other silent films that have been rescored many times include The Passion of Joan of Arc from 1928, and of course, 1920's The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one—
great creepy film.
Yeah, great creepy film with some wonderful, surreal German sets.
Yeah, the German Expressionist period.
Yeah. Sort of
the sets are not designed to be realistic. You know, they are all these bizarre, sharp angles. I remember a scene, maybe I'm imagining this, I remember a scene where somebody sits on a stool that's just way too tall to be a stool.
But yeah, I would love to see more of this sort of exercise with films.
Yeah. So if you're an electronic artist or any kind of musician out there and you like these old films as well, score some Georges Méliès.
Yes, and then tell us about it and we will promote it on the show.
Or score some Alice Guy Blaché. That would be cool too.
Yeah, but that's probably going to be just like part of a track, right, for most of those.
Well, for the early ones it will. I mean, mm-hmm. like, so The Cabbage Fairy is less than a minute long. But of course, along her career, films got longer and the films she made got longer.
Right, but I could see that could also be a worthwhile experiment. Like, what can you do with a really short film?
Mm-hmm.
Like what, what can you apply to it musically to really bring it to life, especially for modern viewers? All right. So we've talked a little bit about, how effective films are in manipulating our cognitive functions because that's ultimately the thing about it, right? When you watch certainly a great film or even a good film or even a bad film that has something captivating about it, like it is captivating. It takes mm-hmm. over your mind. It takes over your thought processes. Like it becomes your new sight. It becomes reality for your brain.
Well, yeah, we have the expression that you can become lost in a film or lost mm-hmm. in a narrative. And of course, that's a metaphor, but to some degree, it's kind of a little bit literally correct. I mean, at least in the mental sense that there's often while you're watching a film some degree of distance where you're sort of going in and out of being there with the characters and then having mm-hmm. a thought that's disconnected. But there are times when you just disappear. You just become the narrative. You just become a part of it. Your whole consciousness is the character within the narrative. And films do this in a way that I think it's even more seamless and it's easier for it to happen with films than it is with something that requires more cognitive effort like reading a text narrative.
Yeah. I mean, well, also the film, a really good film, certainly a modern film, is going to employ music. It's going to employ visuals. It's, it's really using our most powerful senses and changing the way the way we're viewing the world, at least for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking into this a little bit, and I was reading The Science of Cinematic Perception on the Oscars website.
The
Oscars website has a wonderful overview of a series of lectures that they hosted.
Oh, I didn't even know they did features and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And this one was a pretty cool one. This one involved a series, like basically you had professional researchers in film and cognition, and then they were paired on stage with various directors and filmmakers and sort of film world experts, mm-hmm. and they talked about what the evidence said about the psychological, the neurological effects of film. For instance, some of the lectures included Tim J. Smith, a senior lecturer in psychological sciences at Birkbeck, University of London, who specializes in the study of visual cognition, as well as Yuri Hassan, an associate professor of psychology and neurosciences at Princeton University, who used fMRI to look at how we view films.
We've talked about Yuri Hassan before on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I think we discussed him in part two of our episode about against narratives.
Yeah. So Hassan, for instance, they pointed out, observed that showing the movie Dog Day Afternoon from 1975 engaged 63% to 73% of a viewer's brain.
Well, that's a good one to use. Dog Day Afternoon will engage 73% of my entire body.
Well, yeah, it's a very well made movie with great pacing to it. Uh-huh. But yeah, it just shows like how well it captivates us. Some other things that came up in this article and in these lectures, that there's some connection between blinks and cuts and between our blinks and a character's blinks. James Cutting, chair of the Department of Psychology at Cornell University, has tracked the downward trajectory in average shot duration, which he says has been, quote, consistent and uninterrupted since the silent era.
Oh, yeah. So films used to have longer uninterrupted shots. You just have the camera trained on something without cutting away, and the cuts are getting faster and faster.
Right. Now, you still find plenty of, smaller films, art films especially, that will really go for those long, drawn-out scenes. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, yeah, everything gets flashier and flashier.
I mean, if you've seen like a battle scene in Game of Thrones, you'll know what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. Or heck, I feel like everything's more laid back there. If you watch something like a Transformers movie or a modern Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, it's like, I don't even know what's happening. It's just a million things happening a second.
It's just bombarding the eyes and the brain.
Yes.
Constant changes.
Some more findings. This one, according to Jeffrey M. Zaks, a psychologist and neuroscientist, found that scenes from the films Stepmom, Sophie's Choice, and oddly enough, The Ring 2.
The Ring 2, all
right. I don't know
right.
why The Ring 2 and not – I mean, the first American Ring film uh-huh. is terrific and probably one of my favorite horror films. Uh-huh. Second one is a sequel to a great film.
The second one takes everything that's scary in the first one and makes it funny. So, I don't know. That's sort of interesting.
I mainly just remember it being kind of boring and at times wet, like there's a lot of water in it or something.
Yeah, it's pretty wet. I mean.
but anyway.
It's got that creepy girl scampering like a cockroach all over the place.
Yeah. Well, that in and of itself is good, I guess. But at any rate, scenes from these films were shown to individuals in fMRI and it was found to produce, quote, complex responses deep within the brain and generated activity beyond normal cognitive levels. So as much as we might harp on The Ring 2, the idea is that when you're watching it, it can engage your mind more than most things in life.
Oh, I believe that, yeah.
And then another one.
We are profoundly familiar with having deep thoughts about bad movies.
Oh,
we talk about this all the time.
Absolutely, yeah. I feel like I'm more engaged with a good bad film than with a part of it is like, is the movie doing the thinking for me or am I left to do the thinking? And sometimes it's the latter example that produces the most brain activity.
I think you're right about that.
And one more bit from this article in this lecture series. Talma Hendler, founder and director of the Functional Brain Center at Tel Aviv Swarovski Medical Center, has found that certain scenes from Black Swan, this is, of course, it's a surreal kind of horror movie about ballerinas.
Is it Darren Aronofsky?
Yeah, it's an Aronofsky film.
Yeah. Starring Natalie Portman, right?
Yeah, kind of a Suspiria feel to it. Mm-hmm. Hindler found that watching certain scenes from this would produce, quote, results that Hindler compared to a schizophrenia-like state with the cognitive and emotional centers of the brain operating dramatically in and out of sync.
Well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, so one thing I think we could say from this that movies do is in a way they produce a slightly altered state of consciousness,
yeah.
Which also, of course, some drugs do. I mean, there's a whole thing about like people taking psychoactive or psychogenic drugs to produce some effects that somewhat mirror aspects of psychosis. In many cases, people, you know, like intentionally do things to their brains that they wouldn't want to be like stuck with or unable to turn off, but mm-hmm. like they'll experiment with them in a controlled setting. And I wonder if visual storytelling like film can also be considered a form of that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think you think of like, for instance, just really interesting examples of psychedelic cinema. You know, mm-hmm. now some examples of psychedelic cinema are just, you know, bad movies trying to cash in on whatever the psychedelic craze was at the time, certainly mm-hmm. like in the 60s or, you know, or even in the 70s. But then you have those examples where they're really like playing with your perceptions of reality in a way that feels more authentic and is ultimately more upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, you know, point to various examples of this. I mean, even 2001: A Space Odyssey. You know,
oh,
I
yeah.
mean, that's a film that really kind of messes with your perception of reality, not in terms of like thinking about the nature of reality, but just like purely the way that you're experiencing the film.
One of my favorites, definitely. And yeah. if you'd like to hear Robert and I talk more about 2001: A Space Odyssey, we have a whole episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind about it. You can go look up.
Oh, yeah. I want to come back just briefly, though, to, you know, we were talking earlier about how all the tools of filmmaking were not developed at once. So they mm-hmm. were developed gradually over time. I wanted to just run through one quick example of this. And that for that, I want to talk about the jump scare.
Oh, boy.
So
one of the best.
Joe, describe a good jump scare to our listeners in case they're not familiar.
Okay. So a little bit of tension building goes on. This is usually aided by a character being – I mean, it can be anything, but I'll paint one for you. A character okay. is left alone in a horror movie. Nothing all that dangerous has happened in a while, so the audience's guard is up. They think maybe something's about to happen. A character is alone in a house wandering around asking, is anybody there? Hello? Hello? The music is not in full force. Maybe it's tinkling a little bit on mm-hmm. the diddle, you know. And then the character opens the closet and a cat jumps out.
Ah, not only a jump scare, but a cat scare.
The yes. cat scare is the classic jump
yes,
scare.
Because it's
something suddenly happens. There's a blast of music. Something flies at the camera and then, oh, it was just a cat.
Just a cat. So, I mean, it's wonderful because that we've talked about on some of our shows before that when you're scared in a film and then that scare is deflated, like mm-hmm. you realize it's not a threat after all. Like that is one of the pivotal, you know, emotional roller coaster experiences that you have in watching a film.
Yeah.
But when we look at the history of the jump scare, I was looking around and it seems like the first jump scare that we really have was probably the Luton bus scene in Cat People from 1942.
Okay, describe this.
Okay, so this is just very similar to what you just described, actually.
Oh,
except
I didn't mean to.
No, okay. Not completely. But basically, you have a female character walking down this superbly darkly lit street. Like mm-hmm. the use of shadows in this movie is phenomenal, especially for the time. And you're just getting a little more tense, and then a bus pulls up. And it just scares the hell out of you.
Uh-huh.
I watched it on YouTube. You can kind of find the scene isolated on YouTube. I watched it before I came in here, and it got me. It legitimately gave me a fright. Even though it's just a bus, it doesn't hit her or anything. It just comes out of nowhere and is a surprise. And then she boards it or whatever.
Just sudden and loud.
Yeah, and it's a famous scene for this purpose, but. After this film, you see other jump scares sprinkled across the decades that follow, but jump scare mania doesn't really kick in until the 1980s. It's almost as if it's not till the 80s that you have enough filmmakers who realize, oh, this is some potent magic. Let's just overuse the hell out of this.
Yeah. And then, of course, it becomes a cliche and then becomes a hated cliche.
Right.
Can I tell you one of my favorite examples of the hated cliche jump scare?
Okay.
It's the mirror scare.
Oh, yes.
How many movies is this in? Some horror directors picked up on it, I think, sometime in the like 90s to 2000s. They're like, oh, wouldn't it be great to have something suddenly appear behind somebody in a mirror?
Right. Or it's the medical cabinet mirror.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. The medicine cabinet mirror. Somebody looks inside the medicine cabinet. If you you're in a horror movie. Somebody looks inside, sees what pills are in there or whatever, and then they close the medicine cabinet. You got a 99% chance that when it closes, there's something creepy in the mirror. Either the person's face looking back at them isn't really their face and it's all distorted and scary, or there's somebody looking at them over their shoulder or something like that.
And then you throw in a nice kind of sound effect and just to drive it home. Yeah. I mean, at the same time, if we start really thinking, you know, there are these other sort of counterexamples of jump scares done really well. Mm-hmm. I mean, Alfred Hitchcock used jump scares. John Carpenter has some really nice jump scares that show up a time or two, such as Prince of Darkness. It has a wonderful jump scare with a mirror that kind of plays with the format a bit.
I love Prince of Darkness.
That's a fun one.
It's an unpopular opinion. That's in my top three John Carpenter movies. Oh. Yeah.
But again, yeah, the jump scare is just one of so many examples of cinematic techniques, tricks, and it's probably, you know, ultimately more of like an obnoxious one to bring out because there's so many other tricks that we don't even think of as being tricks. Mm-hmm. We don't say – it's only because it's gotten to the point where it kind of irritates us at times that we can even single it out. But every film we watch is just a nonstop barrage of tricks.
One of the things that bugs me the most about myself is when I catch myself using cliches. And I know I use them all the time. Everybody does. Everybody talks in cliches. It's just – it happens effortlessly, automatically. They just come out of you and you don't know where they came from.
Right.
And I try to cut them out. When I catch myself using a cliche in speech, I always kind of wince and I'm like, I'll try not to do that again. But there's no way to stop it. In films, there are also there are like visual cliches, like the mirror scare, but there's a zillion of them. You know, you see them and they're invisible to you because they're so common, but they just pass right over you. You don't stop to notice how frequently you've been exposed to one.
Yeah, I mean, it's fool me once, shame on you. fool me for 3 hours straight. Well, I guess it's my fault. But if I enjoyed the picture, I'm happy being fooled.
But I do think it's interesting that these like film cliches are not, they're not just artistic laziness. A lot of them also come out of the material realities of making a film.
Right.
Like film cliches happen because of what filmmakers can do with the techniques they have and like what's cheap to do and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The same way that I think often verbal cliches come out of our mouths because we might suddenly find ourselves limited in vocabulary.
Right. But to come back to the jump scare, yes, it's overused in films these days, but a good jump scare still works. And there's nothing like it for getting a viewer that's watching it by themselves on their iPhone at work or an entire audience, an entire theater's audience. They're watching it together. And so,
you might say it's good as gold.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost foolish to resist at least one good jump scare. I'm not saying, you know, back to back, but you kind of got to put one in there, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Look, I don't begrudge a horror filmmaker one or two good jump scares. You just can't build a whole film out of them.
Well, that's what we say, but I think the box office probably says otherwise.
And I would say also if you're a horror filmmaker and you want to put a cat scare in your film, don't. Make it an orangutan scare. Instead, just have an orangutan jump out of the closet.
And then like scamper down the hallway and have it never addressed again in the rest of
exactly.
the film.
That's right.
I like that.
Okay, I guess this must mean we're done.
I think so, yeah. So – yeah, we've not given you an exhaustive history of cinema here. That wasn't
no, of
our
course.
Intent, but hopefully we've given you like a grounding in where the motion picture came from, how it emerges from these other visual technological traditions that came before it, and a sense of just why it is so pervasive, why it is so potent, and why we continue to worship at the theater.
Do you have early favorite films or early favorite filmmakers that we didn't talk about in today's episode? If so, let us know. I want to hear what else is out there.
Absolutely. Your thoughts on jump scares, your thoughts on pairing new scores with old films. Anything we discussed in here is fair game. In the meantime, if you want more episodes of Invention, well, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We also have a website. It is inventionpod.com. You can go there and see the various topics we've been discussing. As always, the best way to support the show is to make sure you have subscribed to it and then rate and review it wherever you have the power to do so.
Huge thanks to our friend Scott Benjamin for research assistance on this podcast, and thanks to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today?
I gotta change the oil in my car.
Right now, get 5 quarts of Pennzoil Platinum Full Synthetic with an STP Extended Life Oil Filter for only $36.99.
Get in zone.
What do I do with my old oil?
We can recycle your used oil for free.
Get in zone.
And do you have oil for my old work truck?
You can find the right high mileage oil to help it go farther right here at AutoZone.
Get in zone. AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful fingersticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.